So by putting it close to the top, I'm hoping to underscore this notion. I'm not urging you to just tell people, well, go ahead and commune anyway. You know, our practice is to welcome anybody to the Lord's table if they're baptized. So, you know, you all can come on up, even though your priest will be upset with you. Or, you know, that's not what I'm saying. We need to respect the existing disciplines, and that'll help us, I think. Yes.
There's a flip side as well, I think. You know, it's one thing to talk about the people that are present in this room, and assuming that there's an understanding and a sense of what this pain that we're intentionally experiencing. And then another, we talk about you know, how to help our congregations and, you know, folks back home do this. What is a way that we can help them to prepare for it? Because they're going to go to Aunt Matilda's funeral mass, and either they're going to go up to try to get away with it and figure, yeah, I've struck a blow for Christian unity, or they're going to be really pissed off that they were excluded, and they're not going to want to talk to those people anymore, and they're going to be upset with me for even trying to work through this, because, well, they don't care about us anyway, because they won't let us come to the table.
Well, fabulous question. I mean, that matter of preparation, I think, is best addressed by frequent experiences. You know, if your congregation is actively trying to do everything with all the other Christians in your place, except those things that deep conviction, you know, compels you not to, then there will be some opportunity for them to experience a liturgy where they can't go up and receive the communion or something. Or some kind of a workshop that you do ecumenically and talk about some of the other suggestions that I have would put people into situations where this conversation could come up. So, or give them an opportunity after the fact to say, yeah, I went to this funeral and I was denied the sacrament and I was really angry about it. And then, you know, so it doesn't all have to come ahead of time. Sometimes the learning will come from having experienced it. And did you have a question too? Because I saw your hand at one point, and
sort of the language that you just used too. speaking of as being denied the sacrament, my dilemma with encouraging and recognizing and identifying the pain that one experiences when one is not welcome to the table, is that what I've experienced, the tendency of my family to be and predecessor of Lutheran bodies that have a policy of what we call as open communion, is to then blame the rest of the Christian community. So my son-in-law, who is Wisconsin Synod, and he and my daughter worship on alternating weeks between the ELCA and the Wisconsin Synod, and when they worship on the first and third Sundays at Resurrection, Nick can go to communion and Aaron cannot, and when they come to Mount Olive on the second and fourth Sundays, because we commune weekly, Nick is invited to communion and chooses not to come. So the sense of blaming as opposed to understanding. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I think it becomes very easy to be sort of conceited. My husband was raised Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we have been welcomed at the altar of his home congregation because his pastor in the autonomy of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod tried to stare down my mother-in-law once. Didn't work. But there's that sort of blame, and I think that that's so very different than understanding the sense of conscience of the community that comes from that respect of one's own conviction.
And I think that reactional language comes naturally because it's so intensely personal. Michael Burke made the comment yesterday in his presentation about revising our worship book. You know, any changes to the liturgy and worship are just deeply, deeply personal issues. So, yeah.
I think that's Tom Prince helped me. That phrase that I brought forward earlier, where existing agreements permit. That's part of our LARCM covenant, and I think that's a kind of an addition to one. To do everything that we may do for the cause of Christian unity, where existing agreements permit. I think it's ecumenically irresponsible for pastors or any Christian educators not to prep congregational members. And that's why I think ecumenical formation in catechesis, adult ed, you know, you speak of, you know, alternative strike a blow or be angry. I just think, why bishops, seminary professors, and people who have judicatory responsibility don't urge this on everybody who's working in congregations, because then it is duplicitous and disingenuous, and it's gamey. We do need to know what the existing agreements are and help our people with them.
And part of what I'm hoping to convey is like an entire package of things that in my grand hopeful vision of life in a community, all of these things would be happening, and they would be helping to underscore different elements and give opportunities for some of that education. Did you have a follow-up?
Hung on that phrase.
Okay.
And I'm glad I could.
I'm United Methodist. This is my first workshop. I'm coming in new to this whole dialogue. And I've never really thought about the idea that people would be worshiping in my church and not be able to come to the community, because we offer it to everyone. So now I'm wondering, how can I make it feel, you know, like a worshipful experience for the person who's sitting there and cannot come forward? Is it only a Roman Catholic who would not be able to do that?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Orthodox.
No.
Orthodox,
some kinds of Lutherans.
I need to be informed about that.
Yeah.
So they might be visiting, or spouses, or friends in my congregation. So what can I do?
Or they might be at a funeral, or
It's certainly in the funerals or weddings.
But there's a sense of oneness in hearing the same word and singing the same songs,
and all of that.
I mean, they're still participating.
Right. But I mean, I would like there to be a sentence that I might say.
It's doing the ecumenical possible, not the impossible. Okay, in a sense.
At this point.
Yeah. And in the hope that someday I'm going to work. And I'm going to work for it and pray for it.
Right.
The other thing is, what's helpful, and the workshop uses this, is called the ecumenical principle of reciprocity. So that when the Anglicans will say the gifts of God for the people of God, and that's the invitation going up, it's in a sense, the other side is, what about my own church? Can I go up or not? The same way when last night Jan said, everybody's welcome to the table, Jan knows from my side, I'm not welcome to that table.
Yeah.
So it's reciprocal. Same way I was in Bucharest one time, and I could from my side go to the Orthodox communion of the Divine Liturgy there, but I would have set the ecumenical movement back by about 3 centuries probably, if I would have done that.
Right.
It's complicated, but the good news, Methodist Roman Catholic International Dialogue has been talking about this too, and U.S. Dialogue. So there's good news regarding this. But we do want to come.
Thank you.
I'm a Roman Catholic priest. I think a lot of times what is very helpful is instead of waiting for something to come out of the ecumenical office or bishop, but the presider really has a responsibility for the community that he presides over. And so when we have situations, like we've mentioned, funerals, weddings, Easter, Christmas, all these times when you know that there are going to be people there who ordinarily are not from your congregation, the presider really should understand it, remember it, and make a point of welcoming, first of all, people who are not Catholic, for instance, in our Mass. And then something that all of us, I think, do, or a lot of us do, is right before reception of Holy Communion, we usually make a little statement, something like, because of the sad division that still exists between Christians, we're not able to offer you Holy Communion today, but if you feel comfortable, please come up to receive a blessing here. You have to place your arms like so to, you know, invite a blessing. And honestly, I think a lot of people, when they go to a Catholic or an Orthodox Mass, they're really nervous because they don't know what to do. And the Missalettes don't help at all.
Yeah.
You know, and so you're standing, you're kneeling, you're sitting, and so we're doing things that you don't do ordinarily in other types of liturgy.
Yeah.
So when I've had people come up to me afterwards and say, thank you, I didn't know what to do. Should I go up with everybody else? Should I stay back? Should I go up and something else is going to happen? Or, you know, and because for a lot of folks, this is maybe their first time being, you know, in a Catholic church because of the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
So, and people are quite pleased, actually, to receive that blessing. You see the smile on their face because they didn't have to stay in the pew, you know. And one of the things when I've gone to other places is when everybody's doing something and I'm in the pew, you do feel disconnected.
Yeah.
So at least there are some attempts to bring hospitality and teaching together, and to honor the different policies that are in place, you know, in our churches. My sister said, you know, I'm very close to the Orthodox, you know, in our diocese, but I could never receive them. And they're very, very clear about that, even though my church says that I could receive them. John Paul had offered that, but Dorca said, thank you, but thank you.
Yeah.
Not yet, because they're holding that as the pinnacle, the crown of what we're doing.
Part of the education that you do with members at your forming events ecumenically, at some point should also help them know that experience won't be uniform everywhere. Diane Lowe is a member of the Learn Network, and she told us a story the other day about being in a Catholic mass and going up to receive a blessing, and they didn't know what to do with her. It was like, she says, well, I'm Lutheran. And she was expecting that that would prompt them to give her a blessing. And the response of the priest was, I'm sorry. Well, she didn't know if that meant, I'm sorry I can't give you the sacrament, or I'm sorry you're a Lutheran. But either way, she didn't get a blessing out of it. You know? So, but all she would have had to have said was, I'm a Lutheran, could I have a blessing? And you know, it would have made perfect sense. You know, it wouldn't have been an awkward moment. So education that not every place is uniform. It is helpful.
Thank you. I was actually debating with myself whether to say this, because this just confuses the issue even more. And I think it's what we've been talking about in terms of feeling the shared pain is important. But because we kept on bringing up poor Aunt Matilda, who keeps on dying, I think it may be important to say that even within Roman Catholic canonical legislation, there are moments when people from other churches may receive. So Aunt Matilda's niece, who perhaps was living with her for several years, taking care of her in the way many dioceses, including my own, would interpret that legislation, would allow her at the funeral mass to come.
That's right.
As I say, that just makes things even more complex. But I just thought it was important to say.
Absolutely.
My practical question on that, though, because does that happen often? I know it's canonically, you know, illicit and possible. But it's also a bit of a tortured process, is it not? And I guess I wonder how often that option is exercised.
Well, I have a testimony to that. When my mother died in 1980, my father suggested that we have her funeral at the Episcopal Church. He was Episcopalian. And she had been away. My mother was a Roman Catholic. And I said, Dad, I said, you know, I don't want to deal with the bad vibes that would come from that. We need to do that. We need to have her funeral at the Catholic Church. Well, they lived on the border of New York and Connecticut. The Archdiocese of New York wanted us to go to a foreign parish that we didn't know to have the funeral, and so we went over to Connecticut, which was just like 2 miles away. And they said, oh, by all means, come. And what happened with that service was that almost everybody in attendance was Protestant, just by the nature of that community. And the priest welcomed everyone to communion. He was assisted by a Eucharistic minister from our Episcopal parish, who was a converted Jew. And the Episcopal choir sang up in the choir loft. And it was amazing. At the end of the whole thing, where almost everybody in the church received Holy Communion, because the priest talked about some thing that Paul VI had set up, where you could do that at times like that. Is that right?
It would be the directory of applied principles and norms for ecumenism. That's the norm.
Right, right. So people were welcome to Holy Communion, and it was just an odd assemblage. My grandmother, who was an Anglican turned Christian Scientist, read from Scripture. My brother-in-law, who was Congregational, read from Scripture. We have the Jew, you know, who helped serve the wine, and we have the Episcopal choir up in the loft. And they said, "You can come back anytime because you people sing."
Well, we have 15 minutes, so I propose that we try to explore some more ideas, and then we can do more. I would like to submit that, given the widespread recognition of Trinitarian baptism, there's got to be some way that we could even include baptism in our living out the Lund principle. I know that there are some quirks in some places and there are some obstacles that might arise, but I think creative imagination could bring a community that is really engaging the Lund principle together to find some way of establishing a common baptistry, and maybe the first Sunday of every month having baptisms there all together, having an ecumenical liturgy. Some way has to be possible, I think, to find a way to do it, whether it's mass baptisms or remembering when you're baptizing somebody in your parish to include prayers for the other people that are being baptized in the other parishes on the same day. I don't know. But there's some way, I think, that we can expand our experience of a shared baptism. Sorry. I don't know what you call it. But when I prepared couples for weddings, we would have several counseling sessions together to explore relational dynamics and Myers-Briggs stuff and all this other stuff. I mean, it wasn't just to plan the service. And I think that there would be wonderful ways that we could do that ecumenically, because divorce is an equal opportunity destroyer. It is no respecter of denominations. The ecumenical vocation of married couples who are represent two different communities could play a particular role in part of what you do. But somehow I think wedding preparations could be done with, you know, large groups of people and presentations being made and exploring things together. I'd encourage you to consider making efforts to hire staff from other traditions. I know of a Lutheran congregation in Wisconsin that hired a Roman Catholic to do their youth ministry. It just has expanded their perspective on life as Christians in wonderfully dynamic ways. And this is one of those situations where the congregation, being free of bureaucratic roles, is more free to explore some options that maybe the synod might find challenging or whatever. And it helps also to keep in mind the difference between doing ecumenical work, like coming to these workshops and stuff, and working ecumenically. It's a friend of mine pointed this out to me a while back, and I think it's a wonderful way of keeping in mind there are two different things that we do. We do ecumenical work at Bilateral Dialogues and Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, and what the Lund principle wants us to do is to work ecumenically, to do all of our work ecumenically. Paul?
In San Jose, we've had another unique kind of example that could be added to that list. The refugee ministry. The Presbyterians use a congregation-based model where the congregation settles the person and becomes the support group. Catholics use a very effective social service model.
Yeah.
And, you know, counselors and people with language skills and things. And we recognize the fact that both of those models offer something to each other. And for the last, it's been about 12 years, Presbyterians and Catholic charities have worked by the joint refugee ministry. We provide a person who worked on the staff of Catholic Charities, who was paid by the Presbytery, and worked, and what they found is they were using congregations to assist them mm-hmm. in the settlement process, and our people felt much more comfortable as a congregation because they knew they had all the resources of Catholic Charities to yeah. assist them if they got into some kind of a problem.
Okay. How about can we do evangelism together? I mean, if evangelism efforts are more than membership drives, then one would think there would be ways we could do them together.
Oh, you can have the first three houses and I get the next one.
I was thinking more in lines of a common letter in the welcome wagon kit.
Oh, yes.
If it's not just a membership drive, there's got to be something we can do together, I think. We can do Bible and book studies together to face directly those scriptural texts that have given rise to our disagreements. Just face them square on to help people understand some of the dynamics. It'll help us to gain new insights into the different ways our traditions read the scripture, which can be sometimes quite fascinating. Engage in joint witness as participants respond to questions that arise in the situation, and to questions that arise in modern society. There's been a lot of talk in recent years that the more we overcome our theological divisions, the closer we come to being split by our moral divisions. So those kinds of moral societal issues can be explored together in Bible studies. You can read together and meditate on particular books, like In One Body Through the Christ is a particularly intriguing little book. Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry you could do in a joint study. This comes from Walter Casper. It's a handbook of spiritual ecumenism, and there are lots of wonderful practical things that you can do in an ecumenical setting. You could even explore some of the bilateral dialogue documents, heaven forbid. Some of them are weightier than others. Some of them are very short. The very first one on Lutheran Roman Catholic dialogue on the Nicene Creed is a pamphlet. So you could probably explore the background papers and everything in one or two sessions. The Church has Koinonia of Salvation. It's really only the first part of it that is the agreed common statement, and all the rest is history. So depending on the, it's a well-used text. Depending on the interest level of your group, you could either stop with exploring the agreed common statement and some of their concrete suggestions to the churches, or you could also then explore some of the historical background. So there's lots of studies that you can share together.
A study that we had in La Jolla, California, serving the University of California, San Diego, across the street, was to bring the Lutheran, Episcopal, and Roman Catholic ministries together for study. And then that led to signing a covenant. And we had an ecumenical covenant of relationship for common ministry. It was a very rich experience. The one who gave us the idea was a retired Roman Catholic priest, Father Eugene Burke, who taught at Catholic University and then spent his final years assisting the Paulus Fathers on this campus.
That's part of the remarkable thing of doing this, is that you never know where it's going to lead your community. Just to toss up a few more. Just because we can't share the Eucharist together doesn't mean we can't worship together, in most cases. Missouri Synod Lutherans can pray with other Christians, but they can't worship with other Christians. So if you have a Missouri Synod congregation in the area and you want to be sensitive to including them, which I urge you to do, be careful in structuring it so it's obviously not prayer, not worship, but it's prayer, right? I'm getting that nuance right. Because I really would like to include those congregations that are open to it.
Can you help me understand how you could have us come together for prayer without worshiping? I guess that leaves me a little confused.
Yeah.
Does that mean you can't worship in the door of God? You just ask for stuff.
I thought you couldn't pray together at all.
Wisconsin, that would be the case. They wouldn't want. Yeah. And it's clear that it's with Christians. The thing that got the president in trouble in New York was that he was praying with non-Christians. So it is. It's not. You know. It's an interesting question, and I'd have to look more at their rules about that. I just know that that's something to be sensitive to, and it's probably also contextual. And how high the profile is might make a difference. I think our our procession down the hill, praying in each of the congregations and singing a hymn, would probably have worked because we were praying and singing a hymn. It wasn't a service of the word or, you know, so.
Well, did you mention lectionary studies at all?
I hadn't specifically.
I think that's the most, I mean, that the fact that most lay people in our churches don't know that we all read the same text is testament to our silo mentality. And I think lectionary studies are among the easiest to do. I came from Shenandoah Valley in Harrisonburg, where we had Mennonites, Roman Catholics, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, and Brethren all opening up the scriptures together.
Yeah.
All pastors and lay Christian ed directors. And it was rich. And we invited each other into the pulpit, as it were, each Sunday to be partners as we were preparing our homilies. So I think that's a no-brainer.
Well, and I added to that this this idea of exploring our common tradition. A lot of Lutherans seem to think that our church started in 1530 or something, and they don't tend to realize that St. Ignatius and St. Francis are our ancestors. You know, they've kind of jettisoned everything that happened before the Reformation, and that's just simply wrong-minded. So exploring the common elements of our tradition would be a key, too.
Political advocacy.
Mm.
And oftentimes you end up discovering what you can't work on together. But
yep.
And it's political.
Well,
that you can work on.
Sure. And the Lund Principle doesn't say we need to do everything together. It just says do everything together except those things that deep convictions prevent us from doing. And so obviously there will be times when we can't do some things together.
And I would add environmental advocacy.
Another one, Paul, would be like Advent programs or Lenten programs, mm-hmm. Lenten retreat. Your parish is having a retreat. Why should it not be all the other church members being in the area invited? I've had the experience of making one of those as well as directing one of those, and it was one of the richest economic experiences I've ever had.
I'm not aware of it happening anywhere, but I would think a wonderful opportunity would be when people are in full communion to arrange for, say, at a local judicatory level, to do a joint pastor's retreat.
Yes.
That they would, all the pastors from those full communion would be spending learning, worshiping together, doing things that makes it a little more bound together with those of that other community.
We've talked about that, but one thing we have started to do with ELCA was to have a chrismal Eucharist and Holy Week together.
Hmm. Renew vows and things like that.
Ordination vows.
Yeah. You're mentioning the presbytery. I know that there are some places where synods and other judicatories have talked about renting a facility to do their assemblies at the same time and place, and doing components together, Bible study, keynote, things like that, and then breaking out into other parts for their business sessions. So, I mean, there are things that we can do even at that level.
Service projects or mission.
The vast majority of them are very successful in
those communities. I'm afraid
now. So the nursing denial we're talking about, ecumenical disaster response, as the water rises, and it floods churches with no regard for its denomination. And the pastors have exhausted each other and supported each other, attempting to dig out the mud.
Well, I encourage you to explore in your communities as imaginatively as possible what you can do together. It might have to start with one congregation. It might just start with your congregation and then the one across the street. If you have an active clergy association, you might have to work on some of the pastors to begin actively trying to find things that you can do before it becomes all things together. But I believe these suggestions are realistic, not in the worldly sense that they'll depend on success by our efforts, but in the godly sense of relying on the cross of Christ for the cross of Christ. Therein is our loss of denominational heritage becomes the shared grace of fellowship with the Son. Congregational embodiment of the Lund principle is possible, and I believe the more fully we embrace the principle, the more authentically church we will be. Joint ventures will be an investment in a hoped-for future, digging canals in the desert, if you will, hoping for the day that God makes it rain. So take courage. We can trust our lives to the gospel. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wonder, with your New Delhi reference, if you were part of the friendship proposal?
I wasn't a part of the group, but I love the work that they do.